Hi everyone, welcome back to the 21 and Sensory podcast with me, Emily. I'm really excited to chat to today's special guest, which is the lovely Chloe Teer.
Hi.
Chloe is 24 years old and she is an award-winning disability blogger and freelance writer with 9 years experience. On her blog, she documents her lived experiences as a disabled young woman, and she currently works in the charity sector as a content designer. Chloe, do you want to say hi? I know you already said hi, but say hi again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No worries. It's honestly so great to have you on. So I think we usually start with kind of jumping right into like diagnoses and things, just so people have that sort of background on you. So if you could kind of mention any diagnoses you have, obviously no pressure to talk about anything you don't want to. But just give us a little bit of a kind of background of you would be great.
So yeah, I was born 8 weeks early, and as a result I ended up stopping breathing various times kind of at the beginning of my life, and that resulted in me being diagnosed with mild cerebral palsy, which is a physical disability that affects coordination and balance and things like that. Essentially, I'd just say I'm a bit wobbly and a bit clumsy. Obviously, technically, it's more than that, but I suppose that's the easiest way to describe it. And then when I was in my first year of university, I noticed myself being slightly more clumsy than normal, and kind of just put that down to my cerebral palsy. But it actually turns out I was starting to lose my sight during that time. And this kind of deteriorated over the course of my degree, meaning I was registered as partially sighted at the time. And I graduated university about 3 years ago. That sounds really bizarre saying that. And since then, it's kind of continued to deteriorate, and nearly a year ago, actually, I was registered blind as a result. So I don't necessarily have a diagnosable condition. It's kind of a bit unknown, but hopefully it should kind of stabilise out now. And I have some sight that's mainly like colours and shapes, but without the details.
Okay.
Yeah, that's me, I guess.
That is you in a nutshell. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for telling us all that. I think let's start kind of almost at the start of your life. Why not? When were you kind of aware of your cerebral palsy? Was it something that your parents were quite open with? And then maybe we'll chat a little bit about visual impairment a bit later.
So I was actually diagnosed with cerebral palsy at the age of 8. So prior to this, it was kind of like something was going on, but we didn't know what.
Right, okay.
I suppose in the grand scheme of things, that's quite a late diagnosis. And that was down to various factors, but my mum kind of knew from probably about 6 months old that something wasn't quite right. I suppose because it was later, and then as a result of that diagnosis, I started wearing like AFO splints on my legs and things like that, and like having like, you know, all these medical appointments from nowhere. I suppose you know, my family's always been like really open in terms of my diagnosis, but also in terms of it doesn't have to define you as a person, and kind of, you know, they've always kind of instilled that you can still do what you want to do kind of attitude. You know, which I think has, I suppose, led to what I now do. But yeah, I think it was always something that was spoken about. You know, it wasn't something that we kind of shied away from. If anything, it was kind of humour that kind of, you know, kept us all going, I suppose.
8 is quite kind of late in life to know, isn't it, in terms of if you were kind of struggling?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I don't really know what I thought before then, because to me, it had always been the body that I'd lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it was like, well, oh, I can't run as quick as everyone else, or, you know, and I suppose I just assumed that everyone's legs felt tired, or everyone had like a side of their body that worked a lot better than the other. So mine like predominantly affects the left side of my body. Luckily I'm right-handed, but I kind of assumed that everyone's non-dominant hand was like my left hand, and I suppose I kind of didn't give it much thought, to be honest. But then I suppose that's kind of testament to kind of how, you know, my mum kind of looked at it in terms of it wasn't a barrier.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely to hear, though. It's really nice to hear that your family were so, like, not on board with it, but really, you know, it's just you. You're just Chloe. Like, that is how you are, and obviously you don't know any different. And was it almost weird to kind of being given the diagnosis? Did you see it as like a label? Obviously you were 8, so you might not remember this, but like did it kind of feel weird?
I suppose for me, like, I don't necessarily remember almost being sat down and being told.
Okay.
I suppose, like, you know, like I mentioned, that the first indicator was, well, you've now got to wear this splint on your leg.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that was like the first kind of, oh, I'm disabled. Not that I really knew what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose that was kind of, that made me different from my peers. And it was like, well, what's that? You know, and I had a lot of questions. But a story that I kind of, is one that I tell quite fondly, is when I got my first AFO splint made, they forgot to do like the transfer. So you can, when you get an AFO splint, you can like choose a pattern that you want on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose butterflies. But for like whatever reason, like they kind of missed it out on the form, and this splint came back white. And, you know, I was mortified by the fact that I was wearing one anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind the fact that it came back white.
Yeah.
I literally was like, nope. But then on the way back to school, me and my mum kind of stopped off at a craft store and got loads of stickers. And a lot of those were like butterflies and flowers and like that kind of thing.
Okay.
And I vividly remember my year 2 teacher at the time lifting me up, standing me on a chair.
Mm-hmm.
Safety obviously wasn't quite up to scratch. But bless her, no, she like held me up, I was fine. But then I got to choose like a few people in my class that helped decorate my splint.
Amazing.
And I suppose that unintentionally was such a good icebreaker, because it was, instead of it was like, oh, like a medical thing, it was like, oh yeah, I put that sticker on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all my friends were kind of part of that. Mm-hmm. It was almost like, I suppose, an accessory.
Nice.
So in a way, it's like, I think that actually really helped with kind of me almost embracing it, but also from like my peers' perspectives
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm. And can you just explain what AFO stands for in case anyone doesn't know? Because I know what splints you're talking about, because I follow you on social media and I've seen photos of you. But just in case anyone doesn't know what you're talking about, could you explain what that stands for?
Yeah. So an AFO is an ankle foot orthotic. So essentially, to make them, they do a cast of your leg.
Mm-hmm.
Like as if you've broken your foot, essentially. And it kind of goes from like the tip of your toes to the like just behind your knee. And then they use that to almost create like a solid plastic mold of your foot, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
That then has straps on. And the purpose of it is to like hold your foot in what people would consider a normal kind of position. So without my splints, I tend to like walk on my toes with like my feet and my knees turned in, which obviously isn't practical. I can't get very far. But also, like, from a young age, if I was constantly doing that, it'll obviously, like, affect, like, you know, like, joint formation and things like that. Right. So an AFO essentially, like, sticks your, like, keeps your foot at, like, a 90-degree angle. And that can kind of help you walk more normally, I suppose. But you know, it's not just kind of an aesthetic thing. It can help with like pain management and I suppose kind of like aligning all your joints and things.
And did it take some kind of getting used to having this like set of splints? Like, do you get kind of, do you kind of work your way up to like kind of wearing them more kind of thing? Or
yeah,
like, how does it work?
Initially, I kind of did like an hour a day and then kind of like built up. Because, yeah, it's, well, it's, you know, it can be quite painful, obviously, if that's not the natural foot position. But, yeah, it can almost feel, like, cumbersome. And, like, whenever I'd get, like, a new, like, splint, I'd feel like I was just stomping around. Because, obviously, as you grow, you need new splints because it's moulded to your foot and your leg. And I actually stopped wearing splints from probably about the age of 13 to 17. I didn't wear them.
Okay.
And the shock of when I went back to wearing them, I was like, I can't move. And yeah, like currently I wear one on each leg, which is something I've only done since university. But actually, that's like the best combination for me, and is kind of, you know, what I've decided to stick with, I suppose.
And do you think, was there sort of a reason you stopped?
So I started wearing a splint when I was in year two, and then by the time I was in year six, obviously with like physio and kind of like management, I almost like upgrade in terms of functioning normal in society, which is what society wants us to be. I'd say it was an upgrade to kind of insoles in my shoes. And that was kind of like almost withdrawing support a bit at a time in the hope that I then would no longer need it. And that just so happened to coincide with kind of year six and then going up to high school. And, you know, I did get bullied for wearing them in primary school. And I started to wear them again in high school because of a deterioration in my condition. And actually it was, that was hard because I'd spent however many years pretending I wasn't disabled. Because there was, at that point there was no visible kind of sign, I could almost get away with it.
It's really like hard to hear you kind of say that, that, you know, you could kind of get away with it kind of thing, because, you know, really it's the environment that you're in that's that makes you feel like a certain way and stuff like that. And I don't know, it's really, the reason, like one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I really find it really interesting how you highlight and kind of openly discuss, as well as like educating about disability and cerebral palsy and like visual impairment. And it's the myths and the stigma around these things and the way that you dispel them. It's really important, because if you don't educate people, they are just so stuck in their ways. And I don't know why that is, but yeah, I think, sorry, I went off on a ramble then, but what I'm trying to say is that, I don't know, it's the more I talk to people, it's other people, it's society, it's not them, it's, you know, we don't live in a world that's suited to us all.
Yeah, and you know, that's, I suppose, highlighting the social model of disability that kind of, in a nutshell, says we're disabled by our society, and that's what disables us. And if all the societal barriers were removed, whether those be physical or attitudinal, then we would be left with our impairment, like our condition that we're diagnosed with, but that wouldn't disable us because we could still access society.
Yeah. See, that's interesting, isn't it? It's like a different way of thinking about it. Like what defines, you know, it being a disability, whereas we could all be on like a level playing field, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it's something that really interests me. And, you know, like I said, I hid my disability. I didn't hide my disability from everyone. You know, my close friends knew. And I think if someone would have asked, I would have said. But it was almost like I could get away with it. And actually, in the long run, that made me a very shy and quiet person. And I think that's almost unrecognisable from who I am today. And actually, it's only kind of through, it was only when I became visibly disabled that I started to kind of accept that as part of my identity. And actually, you know, you might expect someone to become less confident when they start using splints or a wheelchair or things like that. And yes, it did to begin with, but actually it was, I was no longer hiding because I couldn't. And actually for me, that led to kind of fully accepting, you know, my disability and being disabled, and actually, I suppose, being proud of that identity. Like, I know people might say, oh, well, you know, when, you know, you're so lovely, Chloe, like, but I don't see your disability. I'm like, but that's such a core part of me. It's, you know, and I'm like, but why don't you see it? Because I don't see it as a negative, but I just see it as a component of myself.
And you wouldn't be the person you are today without it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So why people aren't seeing the full picture of you and just, like, I don't know, like referring to it as a separate thing, or like a, like you have this thing rather than you kind of, you know, it is your life.
Yeah, and I think when I was younger, I felt it was almost like this thing that followed me around that was always there but wasn't me. Whereas it's almost like my perception of what disability is and how I felt about that has obviously changed dramatically over the last 9 years I've been blogging. And yeah, like it's almost like a growth in terms of who I am. And actually, you know, I'm probably the most confident I've been in my life. And yet, you know, some people would be like, well, shouldn't you, you know, you shouldn't be, you know, you've, you're like losing your sight and you're physically disabled and all of these things. Yet, yes, they're not, they're not fun. I would not recommend. But I suppose it's just me. And I know that sounds really cliche, but like you say, I wouldn't have the job I have. I wouldn't have anything that I currently have in my life, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a really, I don't know, it's really interesting to hear you say it like that, because I don't know, people have their views, when actually when you talk to the person, that's not how they're living, that's not how they're thinking. It's, I don't know, I feel like social media has like a slight part to play in this, in that you see like a snippet of someone's life, or, you know, maybe if you meet up with a friend every so often, they see a snippet of your life, and actually they don't know, you know, what sort of headspace you're in. Like right now, like you're saying, you know, you're really happy with where you are, and like you can just kind of hear the confidence and enthusiasm about like, you know, just, you know, you as a person and the work you do. And I feel like, I don't know, people get a snapshot of you maybe from seeing you, you know, online or something like that, when actually you are this whole person outside of that.
Yeah, you know, and I think within society, disabled people, it's almost like that's the worst thing that could happen to someone, is that they become disabled. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I wouldn't recommend, but I suppose because I do speak openly about my disability and kind of my experiences, I'm sometimes hesitant to be negative, because actually, if non-disabled people read that, that just kind of reinforces that stereotype that it's the worst thing in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. And also just, I think for anyone else coming across your content who, you know, maybe also has cerebral palsy and stuff like that, they want to see, I don't know, the true you, and they want to see like the good and the bad kind of thing. But yeah, like you say, it's tricky to know how to, I don't know, how to communicate without, yeah, you know, it's a struggle.
Oh, definitely. But no, I think it's important to share both sides, but also, I suppose, to kind of show that it is a complete life of being good and bad, like everybody's life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I said I was going to come back to kind of sort of your kind of university days and stuff. Were you able to get like accommodations at university in terms of like them being understanding, but also the fact that within your first year you had these, you know, these issues coming up with your sight?
I think my health has changed dramatically from sixth form to now. When I was in sixth form, I was really kind of struggling with mobility and was like using a wheelchair quite a bit. And, you know, my sixth form were amazing. I went to the same sixth form that was my high school, and they couldn't have done it anymore. You know, they were so supportive. And I think, you know, I've been really lucky with my educational experiences, because I know not every disabled person gets that. I think we should, but we don't. And at university, I think as a whole, there were gaps, and, you know, things were hard, especially as, you know, I had a changing condition. So in terms of like the kind of rules around support, that was really hard to navigate. But the actual staff I had were amazing and went above and beyond. But it, you know, there was always a bit of me that was like, but what if I had a different lecturer? Or, you know, it wasn't something that was universal for everyone. It was my lecturers being amazing and kind of doing more than they should to ensure that I could participate. You know, and I really, really appreciated that. But there was a part of me that was like, you shouldn't have to be doing this. You know, it wasn't essentially their job to fight my corner to get extensions or to kind of like enlarge work when other people whose job it was didn't do it, and things like that. You know, like I said, my sight changed a lot during uni and declined at like various rates, but like quite significantly during my final year. And, you know, your final year, you're writing your dissertation.
Yeah.
And I was learning how to use new computer software to allow me to still do that.
Yeah, that's... wow.
And was almost just like, I suppose, I'd adapt to one thing, and then before I knew it, that was almost like outdated, and I was having to adapt again. Like I loved my time at uni. I didn't necessarily have like the biggest social side of uni, and I don't necessarily think I got access to that, but then at the same time, as much as I loved a nightclubbing, it wasn't something I wanted to do on a weekly basis.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I was like, once every few months will do me. You know, and I got involved in the Students' Union, and that actually was, again, quite a big turning point in terms of my confidence. I was elected as the disability officer and was kind of able to continue making changes in terms of the work I do, but on a much more local level, and actually to get things implemented, you know, was really rewarding.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's great to hear. Like, I mean, just wow to start off with, because a final year is just the most stressful time in your life at university, and the fact that you were also having to deal with, you know, something that was kind of ever changing, as you said, is wild. I mean, as if, you know, there's not enough pressure in terms of dissertation and stuff like that. But it is also interesting to hear how you almost, you obviously are very grateful for the, you know, the support that you had at university, but that you're also kind of guilty that it's not the same for everyone, and that, I don't know, it's, you kind of sound equally grateful but equally guilty for the fact that you had a good experience and that it's not the same for every, you know, disabled student out there.
I think that sums it up quite well. So prior to my blog being known as Chloe Tia, obviously my name, it was life as a cerebral palsy student, and I documented from GCSEs to graduating uni. So, you know, I ended up writing about all sorts to do with disability, but I suppose my initial focus was my educational experience as someone who, I suppose when I started, someone who was navigating how I felt about disability, but also navigating like the mainstream education system. And it was only kind of when I started kind of documenting that, that I realised that I had quite an abnormal experience, and abnormal in the fact that I had a good one. And yeah, it's, you know, there's been stories online of, you know, people I know who have literally had to fight to attend their own graduation, which literally is like mind-boggling. Like, it's like, seriously? You know, I mean, I'm forever shocked at, you know, how disabled people are still treated in today's society, but I think because I had such a good experience, I know it's something that I can't just take for granted. But then on the reverse, it's like, yeah, but that's what all my peers got.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's, I feel quite torn.
Yeah. Oh, it's a tricky one, isn't it? And, you know, also like you were saying about like things like, you know, having like accessible graduations and things like that, what worries me is that we see the same stories each year. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't change. Like, graduation season rolls round and you open Twitter and again someone, you know, couldn't access the venue or something, or someone didn't understand their accommodations, or, you know, people weren't, you know, even invited or something like that. Like, it's, but it doesn't seem to change. And I think what gets frustrating and
not samey. Not at all. And yet I had that the president of the Students' Union basically be like, I'm here, What do you need? You know, they contacted me beforehand. And like the layout of our graduation, there wasn't a stage to go up on, which was good. But you kind of had to like walk across, get your certificate, and then carry on walking like round. And then you'd walk behind the back of the chairs of everyone and then get back to your seat. And I admit that I was using a walking stick at the time or like interchanging with my cane. But I'd made the decision that I wanted to walk independently to get my degree, but then would need my stick to almost get all the way back round again. And the reason for not wanting to use my stick wasn't because I was like, I want to do it independently and almost prove that. It was more the physical logistics of having to shake hands and take bits of paper and and I have one fully functioning hand, so I was just like, I don't want it to be like a fumbling disaster, I suppose.
Okay.
But yeah, so essentially the president of the Students' Union queued with me, took my stick, and then ran the opposite way around the back, so by the time I'd walked across, it was there.
Incredible.
You know, and it's just like little stuff like that that wasn't, you know, that's going above and beyond, and that was someone who genuinely cared about my experience on that day, and I suppose just saw me as another student. And a friend, and kind of, well, yeah, of course, like, why wouldn't I do that kind of thing? And yet, even being invited seems to be a big ask for many disabled students.
And just what you said then, like, it was a little thing. Like, it was, like, you know, it wasn't the most... you know, didn't require the biggest planning in the world for that to take place. Like, I feel like a lot of accommodations are really straightforward and really simple, but they, you know, something like that meant a lot to you because it made your experience of graduating, you know, that much better and that much more, you know, it flowed much easier by the sounds of it. Like, it's not rocket science.
You know, it's not. And actually, like you say, it made such a big difference and made me feel valued in terms of I ought to be there. And yet they probably didn't think twice of it and just did it because they're a nice person. And yet, like you say, it made such a big impact for me when actually it was quite simple and straightforward. And like, we literally like discussed it on the day. Like, it was a case of, okay, what do you want? I'm here at your disposal, kind of thing. So no, it's the little things.
Definitely. And I'm kind of keen to understand, like, after university, what kind of led you to work as a content designer? Did you kind of go straight into kind of the charity sector, or did you kind of do anything before that? I mean, I know obviously you had like your kind of blog presence and you know, your kind of all that kind of advocacy in terms of like disability and stuff like that. Do you think that kind of fed into you wanting to go into that area?
So my blog like continued, and like I suppose the work around that continued to get kind of bigger and more like presence, I suppose, while I was going through uni. And I suppose I had the time and the flexibility to go and do things like talks, because you're not in every day 8 till 3 or whatever, in terms of school. And even if there were lectures, I'd just be like, sorry guys, I'm delivering my own lecture. And they'd be like, cool, have fun. You know, and like, were aware of what I did and kind of really supported that. And then between my second and third year of uni, because I obviously didn't want a break, I worked for 3 months as an intern on Scope's online community. So their online forum.
Mm-hmm.
And that included obviously like welcoming people and kind of moderating the forum, but also advising on disability related things, but also like collaborating with bloggers and like pulling together a content calendar in terms mm-hmm. of like conversation starters or guest blog posts and things like that. And I loved that role. It was working from home. It was everything, you know, I wanted from a job. And I was like, I got this because of my blog. You know, mm-hmm. obviously there was more to it than that, but it was my experience from blogging that kind of gave me that edge, I suppose. And then when it got like near to the like end of final year, I applied for a master's in journalism and got accepted onto that, and also was re-elected as the disability officer, because if third year wasn't hard enough, that was the year I was disability officer. So yeah, I was already on track to spend another year or two at uni. And then I had a little email basically being like, you know that job you did about a year ago for 3 months? We've got a full-time like position opening up. Do you want it? And honestly, it was the hardest decision ever, because they were two very different roles. You know, it was, I suppose they weren't very different, but it was a big life decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, obviously, from what you just said, I took the job and stayed in that role for a year and a half.
Okay.
I found it quite emotionally draining at times, but I think that comes with the territory of it being on a forum. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed, like, especially the content side of things. And then Scope were advertising for a content designer for a 6 month secondment. So to kind of move over there for 6 months, get some experience, and then go back.
Okay.
And I honestly didn't think I'd get it, because so many people wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really fortunate to get the 6 month secondment, but then also be taken on permanently.
And amazing.
Nearly 2 years later, that's where I still am.
Wow.
So I suppose instead of being like, I suppose, frontline and public facing, mm-hmm. I now, like, we use research and data, which I love in terms of, I'm a psychology graduate, so mm-hmm. data and research, I'm all about it. And then we use subject experts, and then my job, I suppose, is to combine the research in terms of like search profiles and like what participants say they need, and subject experts to write a piece of content that's about something disability related, but it's easy to understand and people can get the information they need to then essentially just get on with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I imagine a lot of people listening to this will be able to, you know the complex of like the benefit system or social care or accessing education. And I suppose my job is to write the facts, however complicated that may be,
mm-hmm.
but in a way that's hopefully easy to understand and answers the questions people have and give them the information they need at that point.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting just like hearing your like the journey to that job as well, like just to go back to that. But yeah, it's really interesting to hear how, you know, you had this massive toss-up between doing a master's or like doing a full-time job. And I can imagine that was quite a scary thing to do. But I mean, look where it's kind of, you know, taking you down this kind of avenue that you might not have necessarily gone down. I don't know. I mean, it sounded like you know, journalism and, you know, the fact that you did that internship, you could have kind of gone on to do many different things. But that's really exciting to hear.
I don't know where I would have ended up. And to be honest, like, content design is very much like still a new concept. And it's the model that like the NHS and the government website use in terms of like easily understood information, like at the point of needing it. So I don't know how else I would have got into it, but actually I suppose the combination of my lived experience of disability helps. My writing background, my knowledge from being on the online forum to kind of, I suppose, hear the problems people face that they need answers to, combined with my degree in psychology and my interest in terms of data and how people think and how we process information. And it's almost like all that combined is the job I now do. So it's, it's almost like just a complete jigsaw puzzle, but almost individually you're like, well, how did you end up there? And it's like, well, actually it's a bit of everything that I've done up to this point.
And how do you, I always like to ask this question because the people that I talk to on my podcast seem to do so many different things. I always ask, like, how do you juggle it? Like, how do you juggle your full-time job and obviously, you know, still wanting to maybe do talks or, you know, your own content for your own social media and writing and stuff? Like, how do you balance that and, you know, stay relatively calm?
Firstly, it is hard. So I work 4 days a week. So I don't work on Wednesdays, which kind of gives me like a midweek break, I suppose. And initially, you know, writing and doing my blog was a hobby. And I kind of always told myself it was never going to be my job because I didn't want to ruin the hobby. That didn't turn out very well. But I think it's, you know, it's my blog and freelancing things or kind of what I do on a Wednesday or kind of on evenings and things like that. And yeah, it's something that I don't, you know, I would love to give so much more time to it and so much more attention to it that I can't do at the moment. And I, you know, part of me like hates that, but then it's like, I'm fortunate that I do have a job that allows me to work flexibly, but also I suppose is like the guaranteed side of getting paid rather than freelance completely, which is, can be very uncertain at times. So I suppose it is a big juggling exercise, but I suppose to put into perspective, I got asked today if I wanted to give a talk for an hour, and they said, oh, well, what about next month, end of next month? And I was like, sorry, I'm booked up for the rest of the year. And they were like, what? And that, you know, that makes it sound like I'm super busy, and I suppose I am.
You're in demand, you know. That's what it is.
But I suppose in terms of freelance stuff, I, you know, things like doing podcasts or talks and things like that, I tend to try and restrict myself to one a month, one every 2 months if I can, and then ideally one blog post a month.
Okay.
And I kind of, I need to keep that, like, that boundary, I suppose.
Yeah.
So I can work 4 days a week, writing about, well, currently I'm writing about state pensions and all the changes that happen to your benefits when you reach that age.
Okay. That sounds like a whole minefield in itself.
Oh, it is. I've been doing it for quite a while now. But yeah, and I suppose in that way it's been balanced, and I suppose not giving it as much time as I would like, but keeping that balance so I can continue to, I suppose, do little bits here and there.
Well, firstly, I very much appreciate that you came on this podcast and that I was maybe one of the ones that you would do within 1 or 2 months. I appreciate that. But also the fact that it's really nice to hear someone say that, you know, there's got to be a boundary, and you've got to protect yourself, you've got to protect, you know, your own health, whether it's physical or mental health. And the fact that you've kind of worked out a kind of sort of system, or, you know, you kind of limit yourself to, you know, every so often, makes perfect sense in terms of not getting burnt out.
Yeah, you know, and I think because I've been blogging for 9 years, people expect like a shiny like social media posting system, or like essentially I don't have any of that. I write when I feel like it and then post it. I have ideas bubbling, but I have no kind of schedule or backlog of posts. I kind of have come to the conclusion of when I want to write, I'll write. And yes, I try and do at least one a month, but I think it's more authentic that way. I'm not going to write and post for the sake of it. But also I don't have the time to schedule Instagram posts, and I am in awe of the people that do. But, you know, I suppose I'm saying I don't have it all figured out behind the scenes. And it is kind of, I suppose, on a whim, like, oh, let's just post that or whatever. And I think, you know, I get asked a lot, well, how do you keep going and kind of run social media and stuff? And I suppose the short answer is that I don't.
No, it just sounds like you do it on your own, you know, schedule, on your own time. And especially with like creative stuff like writing, or like I do drawings, like you can't push it, you can't force it. Like when an idea comes, it comes and you run with it, right? Like sometimes
even if that's at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Exactly. Like sometimes, like, you can't just sit and hope something comes up kind of thing. Like sometimes it's, you know, creative block is real, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, it really is. I'm there at the moment. No, when I started working 4 days a week, I was like, oh, it's great. Wednesdays are going to be my writing day. And I'd sit down and be like, no.
You're like, damn it, I've put aside this day and nothing's coming.
Like, literally nothing. And yeah, I suppose it's kind of just learning what works, and always have a notebook nearby if I need to jot down ideas, and take it from there, I suppose.
Top tip right there. And one of the last things that I want to / need to ask you about is I have been following that you are on the waiting list for a guide dog, which sounds super exciting, but I realise that you've been on it since 2020. So I was wondering if you could chat a little bit more about the process of getting a guide dog, because I don't think people appreciate how lengthy it is.
Firstly, yes, I think you need to ask that question, because guide dogs are just incredible. It's coming up to nearly 2 years I've been on the waiting list, so it'll be 2 years in November.
Okay.
And actually it's longer than that, because it took a year from inquiring to being placed on the waiting list. So I'm coming up to like 3 years to when I made the phone call of, please can I have a guide dog? And I won't lie, it's something I literally think about every day, which sounds slightly mad.
No, I can imagine. I can totally appreciate the excitement.
Like, because in terms of waiting times, they can't give you an answer. They could ring me up tomorrow and say, we found you a dog, you start training next week.
Oh my God.
So, like, when you get the phone call, it is literally like, go, go, go.
Wow.
But the phone call could be tomorrow or it could be in another year's time. So I suppose it's always like, is today going to be the day?
Yeah.
How
are you living like that?
I don't know.
Just like on the edge.
But yeah, so I suppose kind of after the initial phone call, you have like a few meetings with Guide Dogs, the charity, to kind of discuss your needs and whether they believe you're kind of suitable to be a guide dog user. Not everyone is, for various reasons, and you know, they kind of want to make sure first. Now when they kind of decide, yes, we think, you know, you could, you know, having a guide dog could benefit you and it could work, and I suppose the tick, you then have various assessments. Those kind of include more questions about like your living situation, your hobbies, kind of what you do in your free time. So yeah, like loads of different things. But then it also includes kind of like how quickly you walk and how tall you are and like, do you live in a city or do you live in the countryside? Because I suppose all that needs to be matched up with the temperament of the dog. If you live in London and you want to commute on the tube every day, that dog needs to have a lot more confidence, I suppose, than one who would be guiding someone around a little town that's a lot quieter. So that's, I suppose, why they can't say kind of how long, because it's all dependent on the dog that best fits you. So there are various stages on the waiting list in terms of how long you've been on there. Now I'm in the top section, which essentially means when a guide dog comes through and is ready to train, I will be considered in terms of matching with that dog.
Okay, that's nice to know.
I know.
At least that.
Yeah, but it's been like that for like 8 months. So I'm like, cool. So essentially they start at the top of the list and go down, and the first person that that dog matches with the best wins, I suppose.
Right, okay.
To kind of a bit of context, the pandemic has really affected that. Guide dogs don't get any governmental funding. So, well, during the pandemic, they had to stop breeding, which meant there were less dogs. All the dogs that were kind of born around lockdown or kind of were puppies during lockdown, less, like a lower rate of dogs kind of made the cut in terms of going on to become guide dogs, because they didn't have that socialisation they needed earlier. So a lot less dogs. And then lots of blind and partially sighted people, obviously when they were stuck indoors and like were unable, you know, like social distancing is so hard if you use a cane, because my cane is 153 centimetres, I think, or 155. So if I'm to hit something with my cane, I need to be that close. That's less than the 2 metre distance we're meant to be keeping away from people. So a lot of blind and partially sighted people really struggled, I suppose, emerging from the pandemic. I suppose in terms of social distancing and still being able to go out. So not only did were there less dogs, a lot more people applied during that time. And for existing guide dog users, the rate of retirement was a lot higher during the pandemic because obviously dogs weren't working as much. They found a lot of dogs were retiring 2-3 years before they probably should have done.
Okay. And does that mean that those people go back on the list?
Yes. Thing?
Oh, I see. Oh, my word.
And if you've previously had a guide dog and your guide dog retires, you immediately go into the top section of the list.
Oh, my word. Okay, right. I understand.
Because the training process of training a visually impaired person to use a guide dog when they've previously had a guide dog is a lot quicker.
Right, okay.
Also, that person is reliant on a guide dog to mobilise, and get around.
Okay, that's fair enough.
So that they get matched quicker than someone like me, who it's my first guide dog, because I will take a lot more time to train. And I suppose I'm currently managing without, so it's not like a big life adjustment to go from one day having one and the next not.
Yeah.
So, in a nutshell, less dogs, more people.
Yeah, there's so much more to it. And like even you saying, like, you think it is just the dogs that get training, and it's not at all. Like, the commitment that you have to make as well is huge.
Yeah, so I've had to essentially clear it with work ahead of time.
Okay.
But I'm going to need 4 weeks off work when I get matched.
Right, okay.
Because you have 2 weeks in a hotel, or like they can do it from home, but it's normally like from a hotel. So you're in a hotel with loads of other new guide dog owners, which literally sounds like Christmas. And you spend Monday to Friday, I suppose 9 to 5, learning how to care for the dog and like the training of like how to navigate.
Okay.
So the dog is being trained on how to like help you specifically, but you're also being taught on how to be an animal trainer, essentially.
Okay.
And then it's a further 2 weeks from home, kind of slightly more ad hoc, but still kind of like intense, because like, for example, if my regular route was I want to get to the supermarket, I would work with my guide dog instructor to kind of run that route.
Right, okay.
Like, I wouldn't just be able to go and do it. I would need to kind of, I suppose, get like certified. So when you apply, you need to have at least 3 routes that you want to learn, which I suppose shows that the dog has enough like variability in terms of places to go. So yeah, and then if it all goes well, you kind of become a partnership, I guess, and kind of have to sign it all off, and it becomes like a legal like agreement.
Okay. Does that involve a lot of paperwork as well?
I'm pretty sure guide dogs will have done like their best to.
Okay, I was gonna say.
But yeah, you have to, with it being illegal, like contract, money needs to be exchanged. So you pay 50 pence towards your guide dog. And actually, it's crazy. And actually, when your guide dog retires, in the contract, it's technically a deposit. So you could ask for it back.
Wow, a whole 50p. Excellent. Yeah. Okay, cool.
But I mean, obviously a lot of people will not, because, you know, during the time of the dog's life, their food and vet bills and things are all paid for.
Oh, okay. I didn't realise that. Right.
Because I suppose in a way they're a mobility aid.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I suppose not in a way, but they are.
Yeah, they definitely are. Yeah.
They're just fluffy and cute as well.
I mean, what more could you want in embassy aid? I mean, more should be like this.
Definitely.
Wow. I had no idea how convoluted and, yeah, just, I mean, obviously it's great that they do it that way and, you know, they've obviously got it down to a T in terms of, like, who they assign and stuff. But it's really tricky to know that, you know, people who have had dogs who have retired get bumped up the list, obviously for the reason that you said, and I totally understand. Mm-hmm. But it must be for you like, no, I am clawing my way to the top, like, don't bump me down.
Yeah, like, I've been waiting here a while.
Yeah, like, please. Wow.
But no, like, I suppose I know that, like, if I'm honest, like, I kind of entered 2022 being like, okay, this is going to be the year.
Mm-hmm.
That I get a dog, and obviously we're in September and it's looking less and less likely.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm okay with that, like, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I've got my own house this year.
Yeah, so congratulations.
Thank
I saw
you. it's been a big year, like, anyway. Mm-hmm. Kind of adjusting to all of that, and yeah, I suppose the dog will come when it comes, and it'll be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I just suppose I have to wait, but you know, I've been assured by many guide dog owners that it is worth the wait.
Okay, good. I think we might have to check back in with you, Chloe, because when you get a dog, I think people are going to want to know about it.
Oh, definitely. Okay, even good. My hairdresser is invested.
Oh, really? Excellent. She's like, I need to know.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like everyone's really, like, excited for you as well, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely.
Aww.
I suppose I just have to keep telling people, no, not yet.
Not yet, yeah. Oh, that's so, it's so tricky because it's exciting news that you know is coming, but you're waiting for.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's almost the worst kind of happy news. Oh, well, we've been talking for over an hour and I feel like it's gone really quick. I feel like we should mention your social media so people can follow your journey in life and towards a dog.
Yes.
So yeah, do you want to say where people can find you online?
Yeah, this is where I'm really bad and I'm like, so what are my own social media handles? So my Instagram is Chloe_Tia.
Mm-hmm.
My Twitter is Chloe L Tia. Mm-hmm. Why they're not all the same, I do not know. It's infuriating. And Facebook, I have a page under the name Chloe Tia. Tend to stick to Instagram and Twitter the most, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And then my website, where all the dog updates will be happening, is chloetia.co.uk.
Amazing. I will pop those all in the show notes, and yeah, I'm excited to continuing following your journey online, and yeah, you'll have to let us know.
Definitely.
It'll be really exciting to hear. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.